afternoon, Senator Vitale, Representative Dill, and members of the Joint Standing Committee. My name is Henry Jennings, and this afternoon I'm speaking on behalf of both the Board of Pesticide Control and the Department in opposition to LD 1678, an act to protect Maine's lobster fishery. But first, I want to applaud the sponsors of the bill for recognizing that there are concerns about whether pesticide use has the potential to adversely impact aquatic organisms, especially lobsters. And since the Connecticut legislature enacted a variation of this bill, which has a series of exemptions attached to it that make it somewhat meaningless, it might appear that the bill would serve the interests of the lobster industry and the public here in Maine. But there are a number of reasons why this legislation is not the best way to go forward. So first of all, I want to spend a minute talking about the two active ingredients that are the target of this bill. And I want to point out, essentially, we don't use them in Maine in the context in which they were used in Connecticut and Long Island Sound. They were used for mosquito control and around the time of the lobster decline in Long Island Sound, and so they became the immediate focus of attention as to whether they were the culprits. But in Maine, we don't use them for mosquito control currently, but we do use them for other purposes. Neither product is currently used, as I said, by governmental agencies. But there may be a point in time where we want to have access to both of those products if we have a mosquito-borne disease outbreak, which is kind of where this whole thing started in New York City and coincidentally, the decline in Long Island Sound. Methoprene in particular has a very favorable toxicity profile from the perspective of mammals. And so that's why it's a desirable product that they use in mosquito control in other parts of the country. And a lot of us use methoprene regularly, but we do it when we put it on the back of the neck of our dog or cat. And the reason that we use methoprene for that purpose to control fleas and ticks is because of that extremely low mammalian toxicity. So almost every product that is in use today that goes on the back of the neck of a dog or a cat for control of ticks and fleas contains methoprene. So methoprene is something that, besides having that low mammalian toxicity, has some other fairly desirable traits from the perspective of a pest management operator or pest management supervisor, and that is it breaks down very quickly in the presence of sunlight, and that's one of the big reasons that we use it to the south of us for mosquito control. It's essentially methoprene. Is something we need to be clear about how it's used for mosquito control. It's used to control the larvae in the aquatic phase, so it's actually put right in the water in wetlands and places like that. Again, we're not using it currently in Maine, but we want to reserve the right to have it there when we need it. And, you know, every pesticide has toxicity to it to different types of organisms, otherwise it wouldn't be useful as a pesticide. And the way we deal with the risks associated with pesticides is we identify what the risk is, and then we manage that risk. So in the case of methoprene, we know it breaks down fairly quickly in the presence of sunlight. So if it came to the point where we were ever going to need to use methoprene, we would simply do it in a way where we keep it away from the coastal waters and try to use it more in the inland areas. And by the time it was able to move down the watershed, it should have had enough sunlight to degrade fairly nicely. But again, right now we're not using them like either one of these products the way they do in other parts of the country. Another thing about methoprene is that if we get to a point where we do have a mosquito borne disease outbreak, it's going to be a very nice complement to the bacterial products that are currently used to control larval mosquitoes, because there are certain circumstances in which the bacterial products, the Bacillus thuringiensis variety, Israeliensis, which is commonly used for larval mosquito control, and then there's the Bacillus sphericus, they're both bacterial products, quite effective against certain mosquitoes, but not that effective in some circumstances where either acidity or alkalinity is a problem. They're also, those products tend to be more effective against the juvenile mosquitoes in the earliest stages of their lives and less effective as they approach maturity and become adults. So having that methoprene available is something that's probably going to be pretty important to have from the perspective of public health and managing mosquitoes down the road. I want to move on to my second major point here, and that is the Connecticut bill was based on some laboratory residue data that essentially where they analyzed lobsters and they looked for pesticides and they thought they found both methoprene and resmethrin. That was a study that came that was undertaken in 2011. They redid that set of sampling in 2013, and they came up with a much expanded list of pesticides that they had detected in lobsters, and it had a bunch of regulators scratching their heads because they couldn't understand how there could possibly be enough in the water column in Long Island Sound to come up with the residue levels that were found in the lobsters. So they sent those same samples to another lab. It happened to be now they sent it to the lab that does Connecticut's pesticide agency like ours, where they do their samples. They re-ran those samples and essentially found them to be false positives. So in Connecticut, they've essentially gone ahead and banned methoprene and resmethrin, except when they need it for public health reasons, which was the only reason they used it anyway. But they did it on the basis of essentially false laboratory data, and that is something that, you know, if you want the documentation on that. Now everybody's saying, okay, well, you know, what is in lobsters? We need to go back and do all of this work over again and look and see what the issues are. But currently there is no verifiable science indicating that pesticides are even a secondary cause in the decline in Long Island Sound lobster populations, nor is there scientific evidence that pesticides are harming millions of lobsters. Is there evidence that they aren't? There's not definitive evidence, and that's the purpose of taking a much closer look at this issue. I wanted to talk a little bit about the fact that mosquito spraying, you know, appears to be a logical contributing factor because of the coincidence of the timing. 1999, West Nile virus shows up in New York City. 1999, in Long Island Sound, the lobster population crashes. So people say, okay, here we have a correlation. They sprayed for mosquitoes, the lobsters died off. Therefore, mosquito spraying causes lobster death. Well, if you look at the body of the research that's happened since that time, and you don't cherry pick the lab studies, then what you find is that it's really about water temperature and parasites and diseases. If you put lobsters in a tank and dump something in there, no matter what it is, it's not that hard to kill them. But what you find is that if you do the calculations about how much is actually likely to be present in a marine environment, then the numbers come out pretty small, and they come out in general well below what you would expect to be lethal or even sublethal in that marine environment. Does that mean that we don't need to take a careful look at this subject matter? Absolutely not. Lobsters are incredibly important to the state of Maine. And something that we really feel like we need to take a careful look at. But one of the things is, if you looked at all of the pesticide use in the state of Maine in those areas that are adjacent to the coast, mosquito spraying is just a really narrow slice of what's happening there. And as I said, these two chemicals essentially aren't used in that environment except for on your pets. So it probably just doesn't make good sense from a public policy point of view to say these are the products we want to look at. If I'm sitting here and saying, what am I concerned about with respect to the marine organisms, there are other chemicals in the same classes of resmethrin anyway, which is in this broad class that we call synthetic pyrethroids. Those are the products that are being used all through the high-end real estate, which is along the coast. And those are the products that we need to get a real firm grip on, what is going on with them in the marine environment, and are they a threat? The bill sort of picked the wrong ones, but it did identify the issue. And so it's an issue that we need to go after. The other thing that I want to say, and I would have said about neonicotinoids too, but I didn't need to bother, is that, is that it's always bad policy to do essentially ban any chemical in a vacuum. What you really need to do if you're looking at an issue, and it could be bees or it could be lobsters, there's a lot of parallels between these two issues, is that you want to take a holistic look at all of the risks associated with pesticide use and make sure that if there are risks, you've found the right actors. And so we call a comparative risk assessment. Yeah. And you want to look at everything and make sure that if you're going to go and take steps to mitigate the use, to restrict certain uses, to maybe make sure that certain products are only used within X number of feet of the coast, then you want to make sure you've picked the right ones. And so we go about that in a way that we call a comparative risk assessment. So one of the things that happens when you don't do that is that you tend to ban things without really thinking about what's going to take their place. And invariably, those things that are going to take their place are quite a bit worse than what you've just banned. And because there's reasons why methoprene and resmethrin are used for mosquito control, and it's not just because, we think they work well on mosquitoes. It's because pest managers have already looked at the risks, and they've said, these look like they have fairly favorable risk profiles. Let's use these. In the case of both of these products, one of the reasons that they're used to the south of us for mosquito control is that they break down very quickly in the presence of sunlight. And that's what you want in mosquito control. You want to get something out there that kills mosquitoes, and then it's gone. That's why this class, or the class of synthetic pyrethroids, some of them break down very nicely. They're like the pyrethrin that the organic farmers use works great that first day, but as soon as the sunlight hits it, it's gone. And that's the same with resmethrin. It's very similar to the analog in which it's based on. I just want to point out briefly, I tried to evaluate how many products in Maine there are that contain methoprene. I came up with 242 products. That was just by my count. 8 of those products are used for aquatic control of mosquito larvae. The other ones are almost all flea control products, although there's a number of other types of uses. You can feed methoprene to your cattle to control flies. You can use methoprene in food establishments. You can fumigate grain with methoprene. And all of those uses are approved because of the low mammalian toxicity that is a desirable trait. And so you might say, we don't care about flea products. This is about mosquito control products. But the way the bill is written, it would be difficult to enforce and difficult to understand exactly which products are the target of this bill and which ones aren't, because it just talks about whether it is used in bodies of water or is used on land and which may drain into the Gulf of Maine. And that's kind of a tough judgment call. So you could have people make the argument that all of these products are subject to that ban, and I'm sure that wasn't the intent, but the way it's written, it would be difficult for our staff to understand exactly which ones were in and which ones were out. I only found 6 resmethrin products registered in the state. 2 of those are used for adult mosquito control. There's a backyard fogger. There's one that's used on livestock as a repellent, and then there's a couple indoor products that are registered for resmethrin. Again, I'll just touch on the language of the bill. I think it scores points for brevity, but presents some significant enforcement challenges. My staff's going to have to figure out what constitutes a body of water. You notice they didn't use, if they used something to the to the effect of waters of the state, which is defined in statute. At least I'd had some idea as to exactly what they were talking about. But a body of water, if you've dealt with DEP at all about waters of the state, you understand that if there's a big puddle on your lawn after a rainstorm, technically, if you take a real literal read of what is a water of the state, you know, that could be considered a water of the state. And so I'm not sure what a body of water is for that purpose. The other part is this land on which runoff could enter the Gulf of Maine. That's a tough one. To me, that's the entire state. And does it mean that you couldn't put flea products on your animal? I'm sure that wasn't the intent, but that's, you know, you've got to, when you're in the position of enforcing the law, you've got to take a literal read and try to understand what it means. So the language is a little bit problematic from my perspective. And the last point I want to make here really is about what the Board of Pesticide Control does and what we're about. This issue about pesticide effects on the lobster fishery happens to fit very neatly into probably what's the greatest strength of the Maine Board of Pesticides Control, and that is addressing state-specific concerns about pesticides. We're not as good at addressing global concerns about pesticides like the neonicotinoid bill was trying to take on, but we are really good at addressing state-specific concerns, and we happen to have a really good process that's respected by a lot of stakeholders that we would like to apply to the issue. It so happens that prior to this bill being submitted into this session of the legislature, there were a couple of other scientific studies going on that were saying, you know, we probably need to start taking a more careful look at whether pesticides are having adverse effect on marine organisms. There's some work coming out of California looking at synthetic pyrethroids in the sediment. We have some study, some sampling results from going back to 2008, 2009, and I think 2010, where we were trying to figure out if synthetic pyrethroids, which are essentially hydrophobic, mean they don't want to be in the water, they want to attach to the soil and the sediment particles. Are they an issue in terms of marine organisms? And the answer to that is that we don't know. We don't feel comfortable that we know. But what we do know is that the two products that are the target of this bill essentially haven't been used in a way that they could present a problem to Maine's marine organisms. So what we would like to do is essentially take this head on and inform one of our committees that we've had a lot of luck with. It's called the Environmental Risk Advisory Committee. And in that process, we would essentially bring the best scientists in the state onto the committee. We've already got DMR, Department of Marine Resources, signed up. We've already had a meeting about sampling this summer, and we've been planning to do sediment sampling. We were going to do streams in the Portland area because there's some work going on with trying to restore some of those streams, but we're going to shift gears, and we're going to go look at the marine environment in the sediments. We've got a great lab under contract right now. It's always a challenge to find a good lab that can analyze for all of these pesticides and not charge you $500 per analyte. And we have a great lab under contract right now. We got to ship these samples to Montana, but they run the state-of-the-art methodology, and when we can look at all of those synthetic pyrethroids, resmethrin is one of those, methoprene is not, but we can get them to look for methoprene, we can get them to look for fipronil, which is another insecticide that on the West Coast they have some concerns about in the marine environment. And so that's what we've already begun to do. My board has already given me marching orders to form the committee and get the process underway, and we'll have that committee up and running by April. We've met with DMR, Friends of Casco Bay, on a sampling plan that we're going to pursue it no matter what happens to this bill, because we know there's an issue out there that we've got to look at. But that's what we're going to do. The Maine Lobstermen's Association has experience with our ERAC. I think it's a credible process, one in which most of the stakeholders have been very satisfied with the outcomes of that process. So I would say I can guarantee you that when we're done with this process, that there won't be any stakeholders that are going to come running to this committee and say we didn't do what we said we were going to do. And if they do, then have at it, put in another bill, I say. So, but I don't think that's going to happen. So I'll leave you with these 3 points. And that is that state officials do not support a ban on methoprene at this time because it is possible that methoprene and resmethrin could play a pivotal role in preventing mosquito-borne diseases down the road. Does it mean we don't have to manage them carefully in that context? Absolutely. Again, with any pesticide, figure out what the risk is and manage it. That's how it's done. The data from the Connecticut analog to this bill is essentially invalidated. Those are false positives is what it was. And if you ever tried, probably most of you don't know much about chromatography, which is the methodology that's used to identify organic chemicals in a complex matrix. But maybe you do. But in any case, it's not an exact science. What you're trying to do is you run the chemical through, you extract the chemicals, you run the extract through a very thin, long column filled with microscopic beads, and you base the identity of the chemicals that come out on how long it takes for that compound to go through that column of beads. And it's based on the size and the shape of the molecule. And then you get this graph with a whole bunch of peaks on it, and you say, okay, what is that peak based on how long it took to go through that column? Well, turns out that there's lots of molecules that can come out at about the same time, and you've got to make sure you know what they are. So false positives are very common when it comes to pesticide analysis in a complex matrix. If you spike distilled water with a pesticide, it's different because you know that's all you're dealing with. But you try to run a lobster hepatopancreas through that system, and you're going to be all kinds of organic compounds. So it's just not that surprising that you would get false positives. And last of all is that we plan to do a comprehensive review of pesticide impacts on marine organisms. We want to bring the best scientists in the state into that process. We've already got several of them signed up. We're looking, and if you've got people that you want on that committee that have a good resume, send the name to us. And I will voluntarily provide you with an annual report on the progress of that committee, or you can send a letter to me and ask me for that, but I'm going to do it anyway. That's what I've got.
Thank you, Mr. Jennings. A couple of things. I wanted to, one, kind of follow up on what Senator Sherman had asked earlier, and you kind of went into it, and that's about how fast things are degraded. Would you just briefly tell us what a half-life is?
Well, it's based on logarithm. It's based on a logarithm. So, you know, so a half-life is the period of time in which half of a material degrades. Does that mean 2 half-lives, it's all gone?
No.
Right. It means another half is gone.
So my question is, do you know what the half-life of resmethrin is in either salt water or fresh water?
Well, whenever you look at half-lives, you tend to see a whole bunch of different numbers, and it all depends on how the experiment is.
Let's add photo degradation in there.
What it looks to me like, and I did spend some time looking at the degradation of both resmethrin and methoprene, and both of them break down really quick if the sun gets at them. You put them in a dark environment, and they could be there for half a year or longer. Depending on what matrix. Now, if you put it in soil, they seem to break down fairly well. There must be some microbes in soil. You put anything in groundwater, and it tends to stick around because there's no microbes down there. There's no sunlight. All you have is hydrolysis as a mechanism for breakdown. So if you take a product that isn't subject to hydrolysis, it doesn't break down. But so the short story is, if the sunlight's there, they're both breaking down quickly. From there, it tends to vary quite a bit, and you can get some longer half-lives. If you looked at methoprene, it was a matter of hours in sunlight. I mean, literally 7 hours for a half-life.
And resmethrin is a matter of minutes in sunlight, in both water, fresh water and seawater.
Which is what that's the pyrethrin analog. That's why pyrethrin is a great product, but it's gone the next day.
And one last question I have. I know methoprene is chitin inhibitor. What is this? Do you know what the mode of action of resmethrin is?
Well, it's a synthetic pyrethroid, and so my understanding is it is a nervous system poison.
Right.
And now, does it also inhibit chitin. I hadn't read that, but I'm not saying that it doesn't. But the mode of action in which it kills an insect is part of the system. As with pyrethrin and all the synthetic pyrethrins.
Thank you. Senator Sherman.
Thank you for those questions. Took care of them. I was going along quite well with this until we started saying that Canada has banned, and then you talked about the Connecticut piece, which it did or didn't, or made mistakes in the columns, which is easy to do, because you can do some of this on paper, as you know. So what I'm gathering is you're going to put a group together to maybe restudy what other states have already done. Is that, this is brand new, we'll run through these particular chemicals or a number of chemicals to see what the half-lives are, dollar products and all that business?
We're going to try to look at basically anything that's used in the near-coast environment to any degree, which tends to be two classes of pesticides. Now, the synthetic pyrethroids, which is a large class of products, but it is the product of choice nowadays in the non-agricultural setting, and so it's used all along the coast. Wherever there's an expensive landscape, they're using pesticides to maintain that landscape, and the synthetic pyrethroids are the product of choice. That is a hydrophobic chemical. It does not want to stay in solution. It wants to be attached to soil particles. So we're going to look at the sediments first, and basically we're going to start with sampling. We're going to find out what's making it into the water, what's making it into the sediment, and then we're probably going to move on to lobsters and look at, are there pesticide residues in lobsters? We've got to fund all this and figure out a way to pay for it, but the first part of our work is all going to be about sampling main conditions.
Yeah. Just quick follow-up. On the, and this is in the testimony, too, about the finding in the shells of a lobster. If this breaks down that fast, it seems that, I don't know how they would do that. If they found something, would it be similar to a daughter's, so-called, of this breakdown? So you're going to look at the lobster shells again to see what is in there?
The work that came out of Connecticut, again, there was two sets of laboratory sampling that they did, one in 2011, one in 2013. They were looking at two primary sites, the muscle tissue and the hepatopancreas. In a lobster, your liver and your pancreas are combined into what many people call the tamale, but it's one organ, and
you don't eat tamale around here.
Some people do. But in any case, those are the two target areas that were analyzed, so I'm not familiar about any, I didn't read any study where it was found in the shell, but...
Okay, this is just in some testimony, it sounded like. Thank you.
Representative Craig.
Thank you. Henry, what's the time frame that you're looking at to try to get these studies and stuff underway?
Well, it's somewhat dependent on dollars, it looks like there's some money available in our federal grant that we're going to try to shift things around, and all of a sudden this is the priority now from the sampling point of view. I mean, normally we do groundwater sampling, and we're behind on that because we've had lab trouble. We wanted to do our groundwater thing this year. We might shift some stuff around. We want to get as many samples as we possibly can this year, this summer. So we're gonna be okay.
Are there other questions? Representative Hickman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's interesting that I thought we were going to have a robust discussion about lobsters, and we're talking about mosquitoes again. And it's also interesting that in our discussions of mosquitoes, we've been talking about being prepared, just in case, for what if, a big what if. And you have asserted that it's not good public policy to maybe make a decision unless we have absolute proof that we shouldn't be banning something. You talked a lot about Connecticut, but you haven't said anything about Canada. Do you know why Canada banned these?
Well,
and what kind of research they used?
First of all, I would say they haven't.
They haven't.
Again, it was cypermethrin is in this class of synthetic pyrethroids. They don't allow cypermethrin for use on salmon, to control salmon lice. And that may be why some people are saying it's banned. There was a big incident in just across the border in which they came into Maine, bought cypermethrin as a pesticide and used it in Canada on the salmon pens and caused a big die-off. So it was a big deal. I would say it's not banned. It's just that you have to have a license to buy cypermethrin, and it's only used in certain settings.
Okay. So if we keep going with what ifs, what if we find out in however many years that these two particular pesticides actually do cause die-off of lobsters? And we won't know that because we are not going to be able to fund doing that test. And I have not seen the bibliography of the evidence that Representative Devin talked about in his opening testimony. But if it were possible that that were true, and we're not currently using these in such a way, according to your testimony, that would put lobsters at risk, but what if we are? What if we do decide to use them for mosquito control? Is that good public policy if we end up harming an industry that is really important to the people of the state of Maine, for us to even think about it? I mean, the thing that's interesting to me about this is that we were suggesting a temporary ban on something until we could get more information about how harmful it might or might not be. But the lobster industry is extremely important to Maine. And if there is a chance that these might be harmful to it, would it not be good public policy to at least ask the question about whether or not we should ban them? I mean, it's just interesting that these two issues are so connected to me, to each other. And there seems to be a defensiveness around, not from you, but just in the testimony from other people, a defensiveness around making sure that we don't do anything that would disallow us from killing mosquitoes should we have people die because of a serious disease that takes over the state. There's just so many what ifs in that I'm wondering if any of this is a good public policy. And I mean any of it, including saying that we need to have these tools available to us just in case. And if we find that those tools are killing our lobsters, that's on our watch. And I just wonder if we're not putting the whole picture together in a way that will work to protect that very, very vital industry.
This is a tough question if I understand what the question is, but I would say we're pretty clear these two chemicals aren't killing lobsters in the state of Maine right now, because they are not used in a way that really is going to get into the marine environment. Down the road, if they were, first of all, maybe it is something that we need to look at in terms of bans, but you really need to be careful with bans in general, I think, because bans tend to be permanent in nature, and what we do with pesticides is really what we try to do is manage risks. And so we say, because every pesticide has risks, even the organic ones or the 25B, they all have risks, so you figure out what the risks are, and then you figure out the strategies to manage them. So in my view, if we ever get to the point where we're going to use either one of these products for public health-related mosquito control, first of all, you just say, well, we can't use these near the coastline. We're going to have to set back and make sure that these products are only used potentially. I mean, that would be one obvious kind of strategy. You'd say, okay, we need to be X number of feet, you know, who knows what that magic number is, but away from the coastline, so that as those products enter the aquatic environment, that there's enough time for that sunlight to break them down. Like Representative Dill noted, if the sunlight gets at either one of these, they're going to break down pretty quickly. And so manage the risk and bring the best scientists in. But clearly, what our intent is to take this big picture look and say, are pesticides used in the near coast environment presenting a risk to the health of the lobster fishery? It's not just the lobsters, incidentally, that DMR is interested in. They're interested in the clams and the worms also, because they're all part of our economy, and they're all, you know, every species has an important role in the ecosystem. So we're going to look at all the organisms. We're going to have obviously a special focus on lobsters, but we're going to look at all of the organisms, see if there's risks there that cross a threshold, and if there are, then we're going to manage them. That's what the Board of Pesticide Control is about. What does that mean? You have to take it case by case, but you know, one obvious option is to move them back away from the coast.
Are there other questions for Mr. Jennings? Thank you, Mr. Jennings.
Thank you.
Next on the list against is Avery Day. Welcome.
Thank you. Senator Vitelli, Representative Dill, members of the committee, my name is Avery Day. I'm an attorney at Pierce Atwood, live in Yarmouth, Maine, and am here today on behalf of Central Life Sciences. And you'll see there's a whole bunch of stuff going around. Bill Bell from the vets asked me to also distribute some testimony from him. And a couple of folks from Central Life Sciences were planning to come today from far away, and yesterday's weather prevented that. So you've got me as a result. So I will read through some of the testimony. Mark Newberg, who works in as the Director of Communications and Government Affairs for Central Life Science, planned to be here. This is a company that manufactures methaprene, and I think their testimony, there's a little bit of frustration about some misinformation about the product. Reputable science has failed to show any impact on lobsters from methaprene, and a product ban only threatens to increase the spread of diseases like West Nile virus. And it would ban a pesticide that's not currently in use, but it could be in use in the future if mosquito control needs dictate that. A lot of this is what you've already heard from Henry Jennings. Mosquitoes lay their eggs in water. Methaprene is a growth regulator, prevents larvae and standing water and catch basins from growing into flying mosquitoes that spread disease. And as you've heard, methaprene has a low toxicity profile. It breaks down easily in sunlight, and with the help of microbial action, it breaks down even quicker and has never been found to cause harm to the surrounding environment or wildlife. And it's proven to be one of the most effective preemptive tools in reducing mosquito-borne diseases. I know there were questions before about a mosquito association. They're not formed in order to protect the mosquito, but instead to look at some of the diseases that mosquitoes spread, like West Nile virus and Triple E, which are on the rise in the region. Methaprene, since 1975, methaprene has been tested by the EPA. It's been determined to be safe and effective in controlling mosquito populations. And as you've heard, it's falsely been believed to produce the decline in the lobster population in southern New England, but no confirmed tests have shown that methaprene is found in lobsters or in seawater at levels which could have negative effects on lobsters. I will, because Henry covered a lot of this material, I will wrap up. You know, mosquito-borne diseases can be deadly. The best way to decrease the chance from a bite from an infected mosquito is preventive tools like methaprene. And the science is clear and conclusive. Methaprene is safe for humans and the environment. Mosquitoes, on the other hand, are not. And that is testimony from Mark Newberg. And also included in what was handed out is testimony from Dr. Meason, who is a toxicologist at Central Life Science, gets into a little bit more of the science and some specific examples of where this has been tested and evaluated in other states.
Thank you, Mr. Day. Are there any questions? Seeing none, again, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Is there anyone else who wants to speak against? Seeing none, the last we have is neither for nor against, and we have Patricia McCarron. Welcome.